Hi there, everyone. Everyone, I think we're going to get started here. Great. So I hope everybody's had a good lunch. We're going to get things going here. So my name is Matthew Castell, and I am a founder and partner at Orion Legal Group. And so today, during our session, we're going to be focusing on cybersecurity and international risks in the AI context. But before we get into things and introduce the panelists, I kind of just wanted to introduce this core concept of cyberspace. So why does it matter? Well, simply, the internet has become and is where we live today. It's where we do business, it's where we meet, and it's even where we fall in love. And so it's really become the central platform for business, culture, and personal relationships. So truly, cyberspace has become the dominant platform for the 21st century. So the issue is that just like in life, not everyone plays nice. And so the internet or cyberspace that we've grown to love and depend upon is now becoming a place of increasing risk and danger. It's loosely governed, and as such, cyberspace, cyber governance, cyber strategy are all crucial components of every nation and every business's prosperity efforts. So with the rapid increase in technological adoption, risks are only going to be increasing, and thus new frameworks are going to be necessary to face these challenges. So given that this conference is on AI, we hope to explore how the concept of AI and data can be applied in the cybersecurity context. So speaking today on this panel, we've got three very exciting speakers. So we have first, Roy Kadar, former Israeli NSC legal advisor to the Prime Minister's office. Roy is also an entrepreneur and professor touching on emerging technologies and counterterrorism. We have Anne Kavoukian, a distinguished expert in residence at the Privacy Center by Design for Excellence at Ryerson University. Anne is recognized as one of the world's leading privacy experts. She's also served an unprecedented three terms as the Information and Privacy Commissioner of Ontario, Canada. And then we also have Victor Garcia, Managing Director and CEO of ABC Live Corporation, a global management consulting firm working with leading businesses, public sector entities, and not-for-profit organizations worldwide. So to kick things off here, I wanted to sort of set the stage. We talked about cyberspace, we talked about data a little bit to preface the conversation. But I wanted to turn things over to Anne for a quick chat on data frameworks, and then we'll sort of really dive deeply into the cybersecurity matters.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here. And I must apologize because I'm going to go very quickly. I have 15 minutes. I thought I had half an hour to begin with, so I prepared way too much. So I'm going to go through the slides. You can have copies of the slides should you wish to review any of it. So that will hopefully alleviate for the fact that I'm going very quickly. I always want to start by dispelling the myths. Privacy is not about secrecy. It drives me crazy when people say privacy is about having something to hide. It's not. Privacy is all about control. It's about personal control relating to the uses of your information. Freedom of choice is critical. Informational self-determination. That was a concept developed by the Germans. They thought it was such an important value, they enshrined it as a right in their constitution in 1983. And it is no accident that Germany is the leading privacy and data protection country in the world. It's no accident they had to endure the abuses of the Third Reich and the complete cessation of all of their privacy and all of their freedom. When that ended, they said never again. And they have stood by that. I've been to many conferences in Germany. Every conference is started with a reference to that time. You never give up privacy and freedom for security, for public safety, for anything. That's what I'm going to be presenting to you today. And I'm going to tell you that cybersecurity challenges are enormous. There's no question. We need to address them. We need to find ways to do both privacy and security. That's what privacy by design is all about. This is something I developed a long time ago in the late 90s. Really took off after 9/11. It was unanimously passed as an international standard in 2010 by the International Assembly of Privacy Commissioners and Data Protection Authorities. And I was surprised it was unanimously passed because most commissioners are what I call lawyers' lawyers. They love drilling down into Section 39, Sub 2, Part A and applying the law to the fact situation, getting a wonderful resolution, which I totally support. But what I realized that they also realized was that as commissioners, we were only seeing the tip of the iceberg in terms of the privacy harms. In this day and age of ubiquitous computing, massive online connectivity, social media abounding, most of the privacy harms were evading our detection, and that was the problem. We needed a model of prevention at the front end that was proactive, that could ideally minimize the likelihood of the harms developing, the data breaches, et cetera. That's what privacy by design is all about, and we've had great success with it. It's been translated into 40 languages, literally all around the world. There isn't a week that would go by when I was commissioner that I wouldn't hear from some jurisdiction telling me what they were doing. It's wonderful. And just for your information, how do I go back? Can I go back? Yes, okay. The two essentials of privacy by design, proactive, embedded in design, and abandoning zero-sum models. The zero-sum means you can only have a gain in one area, security, always to the detriment of another area, privacy, so that the two total to a sum of zero. That is so yesterday and so dated a model. What you need to do is get rid of the versus, not privacy versus security, privacy and security, privacy and data analytics. I have talked to a gazillion engineers, data scientists, tech people, and they have told me, and I love it, Bruce Schneier said, are you kidding? These are unnecessary trade-offs that they're talking about. They don't know the tech. You can do both. You have to do both. It's not an either-or proposition. They're false dichotomies. That's the one message I'd like you to take away, that we have to do both. You do not give up privacy, which forms the foundation of our freedom and liberty. You don't give that up for security. You find ways to do both. And just in case you're wondering, can we do both? We absolutely can. I don't have time to go through the 7 foundational principles of privacy by design with you, but if you have any interest, please email me afterwards and I'd be happy to connect with you. But the one thing you need to know, just in case you're saying, this is pie in the sky, this doing both business, you can't do both, right? Operationalizing privacy by design. This is a compilation of 22 papers we did with all of the major tech companies in the world. Think of any major tech company: Microsoft, Intel, HPE, Oracle, IBM, of course, I'm leaving out a bunch, on these subject areas to show that, yes, you can. You can have sensors and privacy. You can have RFID. You can have video surveillance cameras. You can do so much. But I'm going to go very quickly and just... Japan was an early adopter of privacy by design, so exciting. I figured if they could grasp the language of abandon zero-sum in favor of positive win-win sum operations, if they could get it, surely the rest of us can figure this out. GDPR is coming. It will be here in May, the General Data Protection Regulation, the new law, overarching law in the European Union, comes into effect in May. We'll be replacing all of the 28 privacy laws of the 28 member countries with this. And it's amazing because also for the first time, privacy by design is actually included in the GDPR, data protection by design, privacy as the default. This is going to be such a game changer, ladies and gentlemen, and it doesn't just apply to the EU. The US is so excited. Well, they're not excited, they're worried. They want to do business. They're hoping that the EU-US privacy shield will do the trick, because as you know, the Safe Harbor Agreement was invalidated 2 years ago. This is going to be a huge game changer. No longer will people be required to search through the terms of service and all the legalese in the privacy policy to find the opt-out box that says only use my information for the primary purpose intended. They're not going to have to do that. Privacy as the default is the exact opposite. You may only use my information for the primary purpose intended. That's why I gave it to you. And if you want to use it for a secondary use, be my guest. Come and come. Ask me for my positive consent. Flip it on its head. This is going to be huge. And if you think that the regulators in the EU are going to be gentle in their administration of this, think again. I've been talking to them, and they've had 5 years. They say, look, are you kidding me? Companies have had 5 years to prepare for this. We're not going to be gentle. And what is the price of penalties if you're found not to be compliant with this? 4% of global revenues. That's what they can do. They can charge you 4% of your revenue. I mean, think of a... you know, Google or Facebook or 4% of global revenue. Are you kidding? That's huge. People are beginning to listen. So this is the time to prepare for it. And I'm going to go really quickly. Apologies. I would not be so bold as to say this, but somebody in Information Age said it's not too much of a stretch to say that if you implement privacy by design, you've mastered the GDPR. As I said, that's far too bold a statement. I would not make it, but perhaps that's one of the reasons I've been getting so many calls about privacy by design lately, because of the GDPR. It's very exciting. And just so you know, our wonderful privacy commissioner of Canada, Daniel Therrien, last year went to the government and said, we need to update our privacy laws, PIPEDA, that was developed in the early 2000s. We need to embed privacy by design in it and bring it up to speed. So Commissioner Therrien is certainly out there doing his job in an excellent way. Let's talk about AI. A lot of questions have been asked about AI, as you know. Can we accept it at face value? Maybe we have to look under the hood and see what's going on, which is probably a very good idea. How can we be confident in AI? A lot of people talking about the unfairness of the algorithms. How are we going to know what they're doing? A lot of talk about algorithms discriminating. How do we know if they're fair or if they have bias embedded into them? How can we know these things? These are questions that are being asked, for example, by the Global Commission on Internet Governance. And I quote, algorithms are not necessarily neutral. Of course. I mean, they're developed by humans. Humans tend to have biases. They incorporate built-in values and serve business models that can lead to unintended biases, discrimination, or economic harm. This is the direction things are taking. And don't get me wrong, I'm a huge fan of AI because it's going to lead to discoveries we can't even imagine. So this is something to be embraced and have privacy embedded into its design. We can do both, because what we don't want is we don't want to have what is being called the tyranny of algorithms, that the algorithms are going to take over the world. We're not going to know what's going on because there's no transparency. There's no accountability. How are we going to hold them accountable? These are the kinds of questions that are coming up all the time. And so there is a call, a huge call for algorithmic transparency. It's really, really important that we be able to look under the hood and have some notion of transparency. What's going on? Who's doing what? This is absolutely vital. And I'm giving you this just as an aside. This is like 4 or 5 years old, this quote. But I extracted this from a conference of data scientists. These are the guys developing the AI. And they said 88% of them, the majority, said that they were really worried and consumers should worry about the privacy issues associated with big data, specifically predicated on the use of machine learning algorithms, which is like AI. So if the data scientists themselves are worried about this, then, you know, perhaps we should take another look. And surprisingly, you may not believe this, because Theresa May in the UK with the Snoopers Charter, which I should tell you, the good news, it was found to be unlawful 3 days ago. Yes, the court ruled against it in the UK. I was so excited. It made my day. But the reason I'm mentioning that to you is because I've got this quote where she says she announced that she wants ethical oversight of AI in terms of self-driving cars and things. So if a Theresa May wants ethical oversight over AI? What a concept. And I also found this other source that said privacy by design was the key to the future of artificial intelligence. I was, of course, delighted with that. This was a couple of years ago. So I turned my mind to maybe we need like a privacy by design version of things for AI. So I developed something. I'm calling it AI Ethics by Design. And I'll just leave this with you because, as I said, we're pressed for time. But it's all about embedding transparency and accountability, adding ethical principles to the treatment of personal data, ensuring that respect for privacy is embedded, that data protection, personal control, privacy is the default coming out of the GDPR, that is also reflected. It's all about being proactive and addressing these issues up front. If you address it up front, you can have privacy and fill in the blank. AI is an amazing, remarkable, I mean, the deep learning coming out of AI here at U of T, we have Jeff Hinton with the Vector Institute, the brilliant mind that he is. He understands the need for privacy. You know, don't think of it as an either-or proposition. That's what we have to dispel. And I'm going to end by just telling you about one other initiative that I've started, and then I'm going to turn it over. Privacy by Design is in the GDPR in this article There's a reference to a new international council I've just formed on global privacy and security by design, all about how you have to have both, how we have to get rid of zero sum. And I just want to tell you the amazing board that I have. These are people. Darren Entwistle is the CEO of TELUS, one of our major telcos. Michael Chertoff, you may have heard of him. He was the second Secretary of Homeland Security. He jumped when I asked him if he would kindly join this. He said, Anne, of course, we have to have privacy and security. You can't have one versus the other. This is someone who is the head of Homeland Security in the U.S. Jill de Kerchhoff, he's the Director of Counterterrorism in the EU. You would think these guys would not be wanting to be on my board with privacy and security. He said, of course you have to have privacy and security. It's not one versus the other. What a ridiculous proposition. Greg Wolfund, CEO of SecureKey. Joseph Simitian, supervisor of Santa Clara County in California, 25 million people. He headed their privacy Senate committee. I'm just showing this to you to show that, yes, you can have both. You must have both. Privacy, freedom is too great a price to give up for security and public safety. You don't want to give up anything. You do both. So I'm just, if you have any interest, take a look at the website, gpsbydesign.org. We'd love to have you involved. And I'm going to end it, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for your time.
So thanks, Anne. So that was great. And it really sets the stage well for getting a little bit more, shifting the discussion a little bit more towards threats and cybersecurity, right? Because as Anne has mentioned, you know, this aspect of, you know, data protection, we have to kind of look at it as, you know, look at data as something of value, right? There's something valuable there that we actually want to protect. And so what I kind of wanted to shift the conversation to here is, you know, we see these discussions where in the past, something like oil as a natural resource has been the most valuable resource and massive conflicts have been fought over oil. And so I wanted to ask the panelists whether we see, you know, is it fair to say that the next conflicts and wars will be fought over not oil, but over data?
Definitely. I mean, we see the importance of data. We need the amount of data we are producing, consuming. We understand the fact that we need more data. I believe that more data is good, not bad, properly governed, properly used. And we are seeing what's happening. I mean, if we, without going too far, just going to the last elections in the US. Data, fake news, fake data, manipulation was used to influence people. So clearly, and we can go through dozens of examples, without going too far, we can see the Canadian bread scandal. We just found five, six companies colluding to steal profits by agreeing to increase the price of bread, and this went on for 15 years. Why? Because no one was paying attention. We were sleeping. Nobody knew. Having data and potentially having AI capabilities into new cybersecurity and analysis and behavioral tools would have allowed us to find those things. So absolutely, data is the new frontier. With that comes all kinds of implications and realities and responsibilities.
And so will these conflicts, I mean, who will the major players be? Do you think it will be more state, non-state, or even individuals where the flashpoints of conflict will arise?
Yeah, so maybe I want to take it 1,000 years back and then go forward with AI. I mean, 1,000 years back, I mean, if you look at conflicts, there were conflicts on the military side, cavalier against cavaliers, and on the diplomatic side, so people were doing agreements between diplomats. And conflict have changed dramatically in the last 50 years, and now we can see at least three different additional dimensions to conflicts. One is the economic dimension. The second will be the communication and media dimension, which you spoke about. And the third will be a legal dimension on top of the military and diplomatic one. So conflicts have become very sophisticated in terms of multi-dimensional conflicts. And now you add another layer that cuts all through that dimensions, and this is the cyber dimension. So you can run a conflict, you've seen in Ukraine and other places in the last few years, you can run a conflict on the physical dimension as well as on the cyber dimension. that changes the equation quite dramatically, because it's not only privacy on the individual front, it's the entire how states look at the dimensions of the conflict, now how they are coping with it. So the players are changing. Instead of states against states, it's now organizations and NGOs and corporations and individuals, all of them are being part of those conflicts. And that this is a major change. You know, we have come from countries against countries to individuals being participating in conflict that sometimes don't even understand are part of the conflicts.
Data is just such a becoming such a valuable proposition in so many different realms. And the people often talk about the ownership of data, who owns the data. I tend to avoid the language of ownership, especially when I was commissioner. What I focused on was who has custody and control of the data. And it's usually the company or a government department has custody and control over the data, but with that comes a huge duty of care over the data. But I always tell them, you may have custody and control over the data. The data doesn't belong to you. The data belongs to the data subject, the individual to whom the data relates. So it is also to your advantage to give the data subject access to their data. A, it's their data. B, they're the only ones who are going to know if it's accurate or not. So if you want to enhance the quality of your data, make sure your data subjects are involved in the proposition of what you do with their data and how you process it to ensure quality control, et cetera. It is such a remarkable area. And as I mentioned, with the GDPR coming in to effect in May, you are going to see the data proposition turn on its head, because all of a sudden, companies and governments are only going to be allowed to use the data for the primary purpose intended. This is a huge game changer. This is the exact opposite of what's happening now. So watch for a very interesting landscape in the as of May following, because you're going to have a lot of turmoil already. I don't know if you've noticed, Facebook has just issued, they've got a new privacy center they just opened up, announced it yesterday, and they've got these new privacy principles they've put it out. Really, isn't that interesting? Well, it's no accident that the GDPR, the countries in the EU are looking at them, and it's going to cost them a fortune to keep doing business the way they're doing it. They're not stupid. People are responding.
So that's a nice segue into my next question here. In terms of getting a little bit deeper into cyber conflicts and threats, the default assumption in cybersecurity has always been that everything is vulnerable. And what I sort of wanted to explore, get your perspective on it, why is that? What is it about cybersecurity itself that indicates, or rather ensures, or that everything is vulnerable, and are there any sort of structural factors and incentives that exist with regards to the custody of data, as you say, that mitigate, that sort of impede efforts to secure data? Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. So I think that is at the crux of the matter here, which in fact is an opportunity for us in Canada if we are going to lead the effort to try to define how do we deal with this new world. The fact is that laws and treaties and legislation were developed by states, unions, and often very defined geographical areas. And they frankly don't work anymore. We live in a world in which the internet is global. We may have hackers in a foreign country trying to penetrate a database or steal data for profit or just for fun, or to damage information or to damage the economic prospects of a region, or to kill somebody, okay? In jurisdictions that are all the way around the earth, okay? So it is almost impossible to try to apply legislation that was developed, as we learned this morning, 200 years ago, to realities of the 21st century. So the fact is we have to use new models. We have to start thinking differently. This concept of evolving over time, right? We heard this morning about this concept of protection that maybe is life of the author plus 7 years. Well, is this 150, 250, 350? No, we have to change it. We need a new way of dealing with that reality that allows us to live in this new world, okay, where data is an asset. People are going to steal data. Data is going to be used against us. In some cases, we may be able to protect it and protect our privacy. In some cases, we may not. We just need to face up to the reality that we have to radically change the way we deal with it.
I would just like pick up on the last point. I think cyber in many ways and cybersecurity in many ways, and by the way, in another sort of way, AI, this like segue that combines, there's a big issue of attribution. And this is what we see so many the vulnerability is so big because it's really hard to attribute a certain attack to a certain individual organization. It's technically hard. It's hard because jurisdiction, international corporations, because of a lot of issues that are not as the same as criminals. You can arrest someone as a criminal on the street. There's no police over the internet in those kind of ways. It's different. It's really harder to do so. And by the way, AI is basically the same. Attribution, as we heard in the last couple of days, it's really hard when you have AI operating, who's responsible, who's liable, who's accountable for what the AI has done. It reminds me, by the way, of a piece in the paper I read about a year ago about a chatbot that bought drugs over the internet. And there was a question whether the owner of that bot was conducting a legal activity of buying drugs, but that was not how the bot was programmed. The bot was actually tried to do so. So it's really, attribution is a major issue in terms of cybersecurity as well as in terms of artificial intelligence. And this is why it's so, the conception is everything is vulnerable because you can't really trace it back to the perpetrator of the actions.
In terms of the value of data, the harm that can arise out of data, I mean, it's just off the scale. Last year was called the year of the data breach. I mean, there's just massive number of data breaches. And what it speaks to in terms of what companies should be doing, there are some obvious things companies can be doing. First of all, the majority of the data breaches were all because of poor inside management. It's not even inside jobs in terms of rogue employees. It's just poorly secured data, poorly handled data, readily accessible to the bad guys. You have to have the walls up in terms of security. It is just staggering to me how companies, the size of, I mean, Equifax, I'm sure you all heard about the Equifax breach last year, unbelievable that they wouldn't immediately put the walls up when they were advised of a security weakness. And, you know, 100 stories like that. So increasingly, companies are understanding that data, while it has enormous value, it also has enormous risk. So A, if you no longer need the data, get rid of it. The notion of having data just because it might be valuable in the future is actually changing because of the enormous harm, the potential harm that may be associated with it in the event of a data breach or a data risk. Alternatively, you can encrypt data at rest, so you can strongly protect that data so that it will be resistant to cybersecurity attacks or just poor management on the part of your staff. You can do these measures. When you have personally identifiable data, that is the biggest risk, obviously, in terms of privacy, but also to you, because if there is a data breach, they're no longer lawsuits, they're class action lawsuits that are being brought against companies. Equifax, obviously, all 50 states have class action lawsuits already initiated against them. And that's across the board. That's the pattern that's happening. So the cost to you is enormous. And you don't need to bear that cost if you are proactive in terms of the kind of privacy protective security measures you invoke. And this isn't rocket science. You know, this is stuff you should be doing anyway. But it's proper management, proper security, proper privacy, all embedded.
So that's interesting. I wanted to pick up on something that Mr. Garcia mentioned, where he said that all brand new frameworks are needed, right? And in this discussion with regards to why is there this default, everything is vulnerable, one thing that I've noticed in my practice is that a lot of businesses who hold access to data and who develop software products using people's data, the incentives for them to go the extra mile to protect that data are incredibly low, meaning that the incentives, you know, I deal with software companies who, I mean, the idea is to make money, number one. That's the incentive, right? And to ship product as fast as possible. And so what I'm noticing as well is that if you're talking about incentives that computer firms and controllers of data have, the incentives mitigate in favor of vulnerability, meaning we're shipping software and we're shipping code quickly. And if you actually look at the legal frameworks around liability for vulnerabilities, they're very low, right? I mean, if you actually look at the jurisprudence around liability with regards to terms and conditions and whatnot, it's actually quite lax. And so there's really a lack of legal recourse for consumers. And therefore, I think that just that structural factor in terms of incentives for big business and or not even big business, even startups, who are in control of people's data, if you're actually really concerned about improving vulnerabilities, then you've got to look at maybe rethinking the liability frameworks that exist with regards to the businesses that control data. So it's something that I've noticed. And another thing that I've noticed with regards to this as well, and maybe we can comment on that actually, in terms of changing the legal framework surrounding liability and how that mitigates in favor of vulnerability.
And we as humans have a bad history learning from previous mistakes. Right? And I mean, when we analyze the data, I mean, the effect of the Equi failure was astronomical, the amount of money lost. If we add that to the Yahoo problem, to the Volkswagen problem, to the bread scandal, I mean, the amount of money adds to the trillions, okay? Yet, we are not investing a few hundred millions to fix it, okay? We are not investing the effort or the willpower or even to legislate enabling proper governance. We are fearful of implementing things that may snoop on our own employees, who often are the source of the breach. Mm-hmm. The majority of breaches today happen by insiders, mm-hmm. you see? So clearly, this points to some major changes we need to make as a society, as business. We have to understand what is motivating this. I mean, we know that capitalism is driving data and AI and all of these changes. The need to reduce costs, to improve efficiency. We talk about the value of data, but are we investing enough to protect it? I mean, what do we protect more, a tank full of gas or a database, right? So I think it takes a bit of education, change, more discussion, and frankly, that is potentially the role of the role of the government to provide some direction here. See, wait a second, the game has to change.
But would it be fair to say that the government has conflicting incentives as well, right? I mean, one thing that I notice is that there at times, when you look at an organization like the NSA, let's say, right? At times, they even other regulatory bodies in the United States that monitor data use and whatnot, sometimes they have an incentive to be incredibly hard on companies that are not protecting data well, and other times they have incentives to not because they want to snoop themselves, right? And so I think there's a really interesting tension there. Maybe we can comment on that in terms of how do we address, effectively, as a government, these conflicting incentives, which we can deny it as much as we want, but they do exist, right? And there's a real debate in this sort of area around how, from government's perspective, do you strike this balance between, sometimes we want to have access and other times we want to, talk about privacy and implementing, new frameworks around data protection and imposing all these restrictions on business, but then we want in, right?
So it's actually two different points, which I think combines together. So the first one would be, I at least expect my government not only to protect critical national infrastructure, which is the role of government, but also to protect or to do its best to protect individuals' privacy and data in the cybersecurity space. Now, that's not been done, not in my government, not in any other government. It's really hard to protect any household in the cybersecurity. And that may be because of economic reasons and resources that can't be done overall, but there's a lot that can be done in the middle to increase protection. One of this is actually creating the standards in which individual households and service providers should provide you to increase the protections in your house. Because now, anyone who invades my computer and there's a ransomware, pay me half a Bitcoin or two Bitcoin because the Bitcoin has depreciated today. Nobody does anything. There's not going to be even a police investigation. And nobody is going to go after the perpetrator. So the idea is creating the kind of standard that I can feel much more safer over my data in my household. That's the one point. The second point would be, and so now I'll go the other way around. I was struck by the debate about 2 years ago post the San Bernardino incident in the US between the NSA, who actually wanted Apple to provide them some kind of a backdoor into the one of the phones that was captured. And there was a big debate between Apple and the NSA. And there was a survey I read about a month afterwards, and the public opinion was completely for Apple and against the NSA.
That's right.
And I was right, because Apple, that's a private business. Basically, it's a public company. It's owned by shareholders. Their aim is to make profits. The NSA, on the other hand, it's a government agency. Wait a second.
With due respect.
It's a government agency, which is...
Oh, my God.
Respect
you
to
are
the
defending
NSA.
The NSA.
No, this is perfect. Let's have a debate here.
I'm actually defending... Yeah, we'll defend the NSA in saying that the NSA's job was to protect the public by going after those who made the attack. And the debate was, and the people swayed after Apple, not the NSA.
Damn right they did, rightly so. Apple protects customers' data end to end. You buy an Apple product, you know you there's end to end encryption. That's what they tell you. You buy it for that reason, so certainly I do. They stood up to, it was the FBI, James Comey, who was no longer there. James Comey is the one who went after them, and they fought back, and they won. I mean, James Comey knew he could get somebody else to crack the code. He got an Israeli company to crack it open. There was no issue. Issue that they couldn't get into it. That's not the point. The NSA is a joke in terms of they think you think they're securing your data. Oh my God, they.
Well, NSA is not about securing the data. It's about going after those who committed the attack, which was important. Now,
yeah,
I know Apple
but
is protecting.
You think Apple should have forfeited all the promises that they made to their customers and just say, oh, forget about it. We're just going to support the government because they want to go after this. That's an absurd proposition that promises made to customers should be overlooked whenever a government entity comes into it. And the government entity is the NSA? Are you kidding me? Do you know Section 702 has just been approved again, the FISA section in the U.S.? Basically, they can get into anything in terms of not only foreign individuals, but Americans as well. It is a joke if you think that the NSA or our CSC, I'm not particularly fond of them either, but the point is the independent oversight is completely lacking. The CSC, for example, there is no independent oversight in terms of I used to be a privacy commissioner. I was very fortunate to have independence. I didn't report to the government of the day, or they would have fired me. I reported through the Speaker of the House to the legislature consisting of all three political parties. That enabled me to give what I thought were fair and reasonable findings. If you are a government agency, there is no one overlooking what you're doing in terms of independent oversight of the NSA, for example. And one example, there used to be, it doesn't exist anymore, what exists, but it's not functioning, PCLOB in the United States, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. The former chair of it was David Medin. He issued a report, you can access it, in 2014, where he said all of the kind of surveillance that the NSA, the FBI, et cetera, were doing in the U.S., the government, to find the potential terrorists, the phishing expeditions of massive databases, not one case of finding a real potential terrorist was found. Not one. It is pointless. But what did it do? It created a gazillion false positives. False positives are when you are falsely accused of being a bad guy, a potential terrorist, or you're on the no-fly list or whatever. Try to clear your name when you have been falsely accused. I had so many people come to me when I was commissioner saying, I'm on the no-fly list. How the heck do I get myself off? I'm perfectly innocent. It would be like you or me being on it. How do you get yourself off? It is a nightmare. And that's what governments overlook, all the prices that you have to pay.
So, may comment, because you are right on many things. We, Anne and I, have co-presented and co-worked on this topic for many years. Now, one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that the reasons you are able to say that is because we live in an open society that allows us to look into that and understand that these things happened.
Yeah.
You would be shocked out of your shoes if you understood really how corporations use data.
Or governments, please. Right?
So the problem exists around. It's not just in one area or another. The issue is the lack of balance, the lack of proper governance, the lack of ethics. I mean, I teach at Schulich. We have a reputation for incorporating ethical business practices and corporate social responsibility. And there are things that really cannot be monitored. They have to be taught. We have to act in a particular way, and that often fails. Okay? Now, does it fail all the time? No. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So this is the challenge we have. How we develop a system with the governance, with the right compliance, with the right controls, with the right openness that gives us that goody-goody good feeling that, oh, my privacy is being protected. But, oh, when the time comes to save my life will be saved. How do we achieve that balance that gives us both, okay? I used to believe, like Jim Cook said once, that you could have privacy and complete safety. I'm telling you that now, being older and wiser, I'm telling you, I don't think that's totally possible. There are cases, okay, just like we think that the self-driven car will never crash. And we're going to build it in such a way that will be so good, it may never crash. But let me tell you, it will crash. And at that point, somebody will get killed or make it killed. And the same thing happens with these issues involving security and privacy. There may be situations in which it would be impossible to achieve the levels that we would like to achieve.
With due respect, and it's not that I totally disagree with you, but I often talk about the myth of zero risk. There's no such thing as zero risk. So I'm not expecting that we're gonna have a 100% solution to this, no. But you can find privacy and security intertwined, and I can give you dozens of examples. It is absurd to think that it has to be one interest versus another, and we have to give up our freedom and our privacy for security. It's nonsense. Who would want to live in a world like that? And it's not just corporations. You say corporations. You think governments are, oh my God, governments. There's so much going on that we don't know about. I just got a little peek of it, and it doesn't matter which political persuasion. When I was commissioner, there was each political party. There was the NDP, and then the Conservatives and the Liberals. So each political, and whenever it was the government, the political party wasn't in government. They were all for privacy and doing all the right things. They become the government, everything changes. All of a sudden, the interests change. Do not think for a moment that corporations are worse than governments. Of course, there are bad corporations, and we have to out them just like we have to do with government. But oversight is critical. It has to be independent, and we have to keep our eyes on this. But what you cannot forfeit in this whole equation is freedom. I forgive me, I often talk about myself because it just will give you an idea of the background. I'm Armenian. My grandparents escaped the Armenian genocide in 1915. My parents moved to Egypt. I was born in Cairo. It was under British rule for most of their lives until the British pulled out in the late 50s and Abdel Nasser came in, nationalized the countries. Freedom went out the door, the banks were nationalized, it was nothing. My parents gave up their charmed life. They had everything. My mother had nannies, loved having children. They gave up everything, snuck out in the middle of the night, 8 suitcases, 3 children and 1 grandmother. And we came and lived in the basement of a friend's house here. I was 4 years old, this is my mother telling me. Lived in a basement of a house for 6 to 8 months until my dad got his business going. Well, the reason I'm telling you this is, I said to my mother at one point, what possessed you to give up all the luxury you had in your beautiful life in Cairo to come here to nothing? And she looked at me like I was crazy. And she said, my daughter, we did it for you and your brothers. We want to raise you in freedom. The concept of not having freedom is just untenable. We enjoy it and take it largely for granted here. You cannot have freedom without privacy. That's why we need them.
Yeah. And that's the opportunity for AI. I mean, we live in such a complex society. Things are becoming so radically different than they used to be. Plus the fact that the bad guys have as much money and as many brains and as many tools as the good guys have, that we need to rely on tools such as AI-driven cybersecurity to help us deal with the issue. Agreed. It's beyond humans.
Right, and freedom is for freedom from tyranny, freedom from people invading your privacy, and freedom from terrorism. And it's all about freedom. Mm-hmm. So developing the kind of tools that allows freedom goes always, both ways, privacy mm-hmm. and security.
Yes.
Do you think that in yes. terms of, well, we mentioned before, you know, earlier on in the conversation with regards to the incentives that exist, right? The conflicting incentives for government, the conflicting incentives for business. Do you think that this equation of conflicting incentives would change if there was a better pricing mechanism for data, right? In the sense that, well, if we were able to somehow get a little bit better of a pricing mechanism with regards to what everyone's personal data is worth, then perhaps the incentives change with regards to government and private business because, you know, every individual citizen potentially would have an idea of what their data is actually worth, right?
I'll take it from the individual part because I'm seeing it with my clients. A lot of the clients, I'll call it the millennials, just to distinguish between the millennials and baby boomers and others, would say, I would give up on a lot of my privacy and get information out as much as you want, even medical records, as long as at the end of the game I'll be rewarded. So it's the ROI kind of things. What do I get in return for giving my assets? So I will sign Gmail and Google for I agree. I will give Facebook. I will do even more. I just want to see what's the use that's been done with my private information and how I get rewarded back. And this is, I think it's a big difference than the, so like the older baby boomers who would say privacy is important to protect and so on. And those millennials, so I call them, will probably drive a force of change which will create towards what I'm calling, another are calling, it's like the shared economy, attention economy kind of a system in which you get rewarded for any use of your information. That can be done through technology, by the way. If you look at the blockchain technology as one example, that can look at microfinancing and transferring value through the blockchain, which is recorded. It also raises some other privacy issues on top of the blockchain because that's an open ledger. That's a different issue. I'm seeing much more of that today than in the past.
Right, exactly. So, even some of the cures we're looking at, we had a fascinating discussion with some of the promoters of blockchain technology in Toronto a few months ago, introduced some fascinating new privacy issues. The fact is that because everything is new, because everything is a new environment, we need to rethink how we deal with it. Okay? Mm-hmm. And
I just think that, you know, it's, I think that the elephant in the room sometimes in these conversations with regards to, is it privacy? Is it innovation? Is it security? Is it freedom? I think that there needs to be a little bit more thought put into what value individuals are ascribing to their data. And I think that, you know, I actually want to open it up to the floor here. I mean, I think...
I'd like to respond.
Sure, absolutely.
I didn't have a chance to respond to this. You're absolutely right. First of all, privacy is all about what the individual wants to do with their information. So, like, privacy is not a religion. You want to give away your information? Be my guest, as long as you are in control of making that decision. And in terms of the data exchange, the monetary value, if you want to negotiate with a company and, you know, you value your information this way, and they, by all means, that's your prerogative. There's no question. In fact, it was just a study that came out in the States that AT&T, if you allow them to use your data, et cetera, your customer, you can use their services for free. Otherwise, they charge you $600 to $800 a year for use of their services, and you decide. That's fine. But I want to make sure I raise this point. It is a myth that millennials and younger kids don't care anything about privacy. Check out the research of Dana Boyd at New York University, and two other studies have just come out. I forget the names of the individuals, where they challenge that view dramatically. And Dana Boyd has been studying this for like 15 years. The way kids perceive privacy is very different from how you and I may perceive privacy. They don't have possessions and financial, et cetera. But man, do they know how to keep information away from their parents in terms of who they're dating. I mean, things that we might consider inconsequential. They know how to encrypt data, they know how to protect it, and they know how to share it with who they want to share it. So it is such a myth that kids, millennials, younger people, don't care about privacy. They deal with it differently, and they have every right to do so. I talk to a lot of kids in schools, and I give this kind of talk about privacy being about control, and you know, they think it's not a big deal, information. I give a couple of examples of things that have happened when you go online and girls have revealed through Facebook, other sources, where they actually live, and bad guys have gone to their homes and done really terrible things to them. I give these slides because I don't expect them to believe me. I put the stories up from the newspaper. When they read this, these are things that have never occurred to these kids. And after that, I say, okay, you've been exposed to this. What would you do to prevent this from happening? The hands go flying up. They've got like dozens of brilliant examples of how they would protect the data and ensure it goes to the right hands and to only the right people. You've got to put it on their agenda as to why it might matter, and then the decisions have to lie with them, of course. But it is a myth that millennials and younger people don't care about privacy. They care about it very deeply, very differently than the way you and I might.
So I wanted to open it up to the audience as well. I think that, you know, there may be some questions with regards to establishing a pricing mechanism, or rather sort of getting a better idea of what the sort of value of data is. I was wondering if, you know, I didn't have any ideas about that or had any questions with regards to that.
So to that point, I'm wondering on attributing that value. So that information, creating value out of it, is a question of perspective. So you're attacking from different sides, and that information is in and of itself not necessarily valuable. So you're asking for a pricing mechanism that assumes ex post evaluation of what's it actually worth. And tracking that is very unfeasible. And not only that, but to me, and this is where I'll kind of twist it into a question, I promise. I wonder whether creating, associating that value takes what's a fundamental personality right, which is privacy and data, and transforms it into a property right, which is basically creating and commoditizing it. And to me, I just wonder whether by pricing it, whether we're really just actually forsaking it. And I'd like to hear your thoughts about that, because to me, through those end user license agreements and whatnot, if you have, if it even more crystallized as a property right, whether you'll actually, it'll be even more tradable, even more and assignable ultimately. So I'm just wondering your thoughts, whether that angle to me is an important one. If we want to respect privacy, we should focus perhaps on privacy. If we want to work about the economics of data, we should look at to turn to competition law. We want to look at data sets and how they work and how they interface. I should look at IP law, like data portability, right? The right for an individual to take your data and to merge it to another platform. How should you be able to charge for that kind of service? What does that look like? Are you working with proprietary formats? So all of these, privacy is, you know, has impacts on IP and competition for sure. But to really go forward with a value attribution to it, I find might make that worse. And I'm just curious to hear your thoughts.
So I think it's difficult to do. Some studies have shown that there are two main issues people have with the data. One is the fear of harm that can result from disclosing private data, you know, either financial or embarrassment or whatever. And second is the fear of missing out on the potential profit from that data. Those are two issues. The problem is that often this data, to allocate a value to this data would be astronomically, it would require a tremendous amount of work. I mean, take the amount of patient health data that today exists in the hands of practitioners, of doctors all over the world. Imagine being able to assess how people have responded to treatments and drugs and things, and based on that knowledge, effect a better use of healthcare. What if now we had to, on top of that, and that benefit that could occur, try to allocate a value to go back and pay everything? It's impossible. So I think we have to, again, that would a private company do that? Unlikely. That may be the role of a socially conscious government that says, look, that is how we're going to use that data for the betterment of healthcare or education, whatever. Today, we give data, we give privacy because we perceive some value, right? We sign into websites and we give our email address because we think that we're gonna get something back that's good for us. And typically, that's enough, okay? Then corporations can privatize the data, can take private information out, whatever, and they reuse the data many, many times and make profits with it. I personally think that if we develop a model where we want to pay back the originators of the data, it's almost like profit redistribution. It just doesn't work in my mind.
Of course not.
Okay, so I think we have to find a different model where the benefit is not necessarily financial to the creator of the data. That's my view.
Thank you. What also just to connect with AI, individually, that one data piece has such an extremely low marginal value. The economics of it,
depends what it is.
Yeah, but it's behavioral economy. It's not the topic of discussion. But I mean, you go into the supermarket, you have to pay 5 cents for a bag. It dramatically reduces the number of bags you buy, although it doesn't have a significant meaning on your sort of personal wealth. So it's behavioral economy in many ways. Even though, if you know that a corporation will have to pay you for your private information, that will either the corporation will think twice before they take and reuse your information, or you will think that will increase your thoughts of providing that information to the corporation that can make all these great uses that Victor has spoke about.
Or so they this is, work harder to secure it, right? The data.
And secure the data. And this is, by the way, and this can be done through technology. One example is the blockchain technology that keeps the records of what's been done with the information.
So I wanted to, I think that a bit of this is a framing exercise. And so some of the stuff you were talking about, and specifically what Anne was talking about with the NSA, one of the thoughts that I have, and I come at this from, I'm run an artificial intelligence company, and I'm an industrial psychologist. So in that context, freedom isn't free. And you talk about it, and Anne was talking about the zero-sum game concept and things like that. But fundamentally, like if you look at what happened with the Patriot Act, 0.001% of the American population was killed on November 11th. And yet, 300 million suffered a breach of privacy. So I think that we actually can look at this in a different context. Which really is what's the general good, which is a legal concept, essentially. So I think that a lot of this stuff, as we start talking about it, may need to be reframed because it's not a black and white answer. But then to bring this forward a little bit into the AI space and people's personal information, I think that you can't legislate, and in large organizations, and we work with some of the largest banks in the world and insurance companies and stuff like that, the CEO, the board of directors, none of them have any idea about what their cybersecurity people are doing, the level of security. They're being told it's great, and in my opinion, enormous amounts of it are antiquated, and just Yahoo, a technology company, Equifax, essentially a core technology company and core to most of the banks and financial institutions. I think the only solution actually is to have an existential moment. Like if Equifax ceased to exist, if they were too big to fail because they lost this data, or they did fail, whereas right now they're too big to fail because they're just so relied upon around the world. But if that was an existential moment for the company, then everybody's attitude would change dramatically. And so maybe the 50 lawsuits, the 50 class actions in the States, there's stuff happening in Great Britain as well. One of our clients is one of their competitors, and they're seeing their business expand dramatically. Like, these kind of things may be the things that actually drive change more than legislation ever could. Because at the end of the day, most of us know that there are penalties for certain infractions that we have when we drive our cars. Knowing what the dollar value of it is probably doesn't make a big difference. And if anybody's sped along the highway and you pass those signs that tell you what the price of driving so much over, generally speaking, you look at it and go, I can afford that. So I don't think that these can be legislated. And so I'd love to hear what you think about that.
I actually agree with you, but I also think there's a role for legislation. Legislation can't keep up with the pace of technology, first of all. It's impossible. I mean, the laws we have here in Canada, well, and the U.S. is even worse, just don't keep pace. And, I mean, the privacy law in FIPPA in Ontario was introduced late 90s, PIPEDA federally, early 2000s. I mean, it's ridiculous. They can't keep pace. I think the GDPR is going to change that because it will have a pervasive influence everywhere. But there's no question you cannot rely on legislation alone. That will just catch the tail end of some of the really bad players. When I was commissioner, one of the papers we wrote was directed at boards of directors, and the title was simply, "What You Don't Know Can Hurt You." And I think it's really important to educate the senior executives and the people on boards to get in touch with what the heck's going on in their companies. You can't just have this aloof position at the top and accept that everything is fine. You've got to drill down. You have to actually go down, get rid of the silos, talk to people. So I think it's really important to have an awareness within companies and organizations that legislation does exist for the really bad things, of course, but worse than that can be the day-to-day activities that will drive your business down dramatically, your share price. You mentioned Equifax, of course, and it can have real, like, target. There's no target in Canada anymore. You know that there was a big breach a couple of years ago in the States, and the CEO of Target resigned, and the president of Target Canada was fired, and then Target pulled out. I mean, it just wiped them out. So I think there has to be an understanding of the consequences that can arise from these events, and hopefully that will translate into action.
Just to echo Anne on the last point, is the bad news is for you at least, is I'm seeing early signs of regulation that goes after the board of directors and CEOs, one of which was introduced about half a year ago in New York about cybersecurity regulation, and they actually there's a mandatory requirement for the board to approve the cybersecurity policy of the company. So the CEO has to be aware of what's being done. So that's an early sign of what's going to happen. And what's happening in the world is actually, you know, before you have regulation, there are class action lawsuits and there are tort liability issues. And this really changes the atmosphere. Also, insurances require there are more demands by insurance companies before they can actually provide insurance. And this is important, changes the industry.
For certain level corporations, it is a requirement to be a certified director. And that's a formal training program with the certification. In fact, part of my firm deals with training board of directors on the implications of data, IoT, AI, because that's really where things start. Mm. The board of directors has to provide guidance to the C-level, who then implements the vision and strategy and operation execution. And that seldom happens. Okay, we typically, especially in this country, have board of directors who don't bring much value than just to show up to approve certain things. So now that is a potential place for legislation, okay, to mandate that certain training or certain knowledge is shared with the director, whether it's through a formal training program or a certification or a certain level, that could help us.
I really enjoyed the first comment regarding the monetization of data, and I think it's very problematic, firstly on a socioeconomic level, because it raises questions about who can afford to protect their data and also introduces a new element of bias in that data and whether or not it can be used effectively, never mind corporations or organizations who can afford to purchase that data, for instance. But I do think it raises an interesting point and a very important point that ties back to Anne's comment about students who are when you present them with an example of how this data can be used and what it can mean for them, I think it really raises the importance of tangibility and visibility for people on an individual level. And I think one of the problems for civilians, for instance, is not recognizing where that data is being used and in what way. So I'd really like to ask for your opinions on ways that we can make that data and the application of that data tangible for people on an individual level without introducing an economic element in that.
I agree with her. I find the need for some really basic raising of awareness and training of both individuals in terms of just members of society and specifically organizations. I talk to a lot of businesses and government departments, and you would think that the government people would be more receptive to the messaging about the need to protect privacy and the importance of it. I find that actually businesses get it right away when I present it in the light of privacy breeds innovation. Privacy will give you a competitive advantage if you do it right. And they all of a sudden, I've got their attention. It's finding the ways in which you can direct the message to the right group in terms of getting them to engage on the issues and get an understanding of the value of their information, the importance of protecting it, and how you can impart this knowledge. It's not that hard to do, but it just takes time and effort in terms of getting out there and connecting with the different groups and conveying the messaging.
There is a big effort being done in industry now to understand the true monetization opportunities of data. How do we monetize data? How do we monetize AI? How do we monetize any emerging technology? And one of the ahas in this study shows that today, the majority of data users, or the people that have access to data, are data scientists, data analysts, some people in certain management positions that really don't have much influence with the company. So one of the benefits for companies that are implementing this properly is to make data available to people who actually touch customers or touch systems. Okay? And that is a requirement in terms of how do we manage, make data accessible, communicate, inform, storytell, et cetera, et cetera. So understanding what is the value and how do we use it to either make money or save the world is essential, because that's essentially what this is for. It isn't a game, okay? Business is about making money, saving money, or implementing some good social programs, okay? And it's crucial that we understand why we do what we do.
I don't disagree.
Yay!
Thank you. I have a general question related to artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, and extreme groups. Companies like Google, Facebook, and Twitter usually respond to claims that they are not doing enough to curb the propaganda of extreme group by saying, well, first, we cannot scan the entire on the internet. There's too much information out there. Secondly, we are not expected to do so. You know, internet service providers are exempt by law. So they seem to be implying that if they are to provide a proper job in securing the public, they need more access. So as Anne highlighted this, what she called false dichotomy. So from your experience, do you think that it is possible to use artificial intelligence to constitutionally yet effectively curb the spread of jihadi ideology online? To what extent, if at all, do you think this toxic cocktail of privacy free speech dichotomy within the context of cybersecurity complicates the task of internet service provider in general? Do you have any thought? Thank you.
Facebook is. I know Facebook just recently came out and basically said that they're specifically working using a new research group that they've got focused on AI or leveraging AI in order to take away the job of what they're using now, which are moderators. They've hired thousands of moderators that are constantly looking for content of the nature that you're talking about because of the public backlash and because of this. I think one thing we haven't talked about a lot is trust. Public trust is a huge thing that's really reshaping the relationship between big corporations, any corporations really, government and the populace. And so, you know, we're seeing that that concept of trust playing out where pressure is being put on these companies to moderate. And so moderators right now are being hired en masse, humans, but Facebook said that this is going to take us a year or two at minimum to come up with proper leveraging of AI to take away what a human is doing now as a moderator.
Oh, just to add to that, where I'm coming from is there's a lot of pressure on regulators and from regulators on Facebook and other kind of platforms to really take all measures needed to get all that kind of inciting data from the website, from the pages, the Facebook pages, to get it out. And for the time being, I have no idea if they're using AI or will use in the future AI. For sure they will have to use some kind of an AI in the future. But that's pressure from the public on governments and from regulators on Facebook. And also the pressure, and also there was pieces in the news that they're going to file a lawsuit against Facebook because they saw like host inciting materials over their pages. I think that's going to do its own, whether it's going to take a year or 2 years or even more. We are seeing these giants, Facebook, Google, and Amazon of others, taking more, from a legal point of view, more so like from an administrative law applying to them than just the contractual commercial law that used to be applied. And that's where things will go forward. Whether they're going to use AI or not, that will depend on that's the mean, not the end.
The use of AI and advanced technologies absolutely can help us find the potential terrorists, et cetera. And let me be clear, I'm all for privacy. I'm also all for finding the bad guys. Nobody wants the bad guys out there. But imagine this scenario. This is one of the first projects I'm working on with our Global Security and Privacy by Design group and researchers at U of T. We're calling it Privacy Protective Surveillance. So homomorphic encryption, for those of you who may not be familiar with it, it's amazing. What it is you can do all kinds of searches and statistical analyses and data and analytics on encrypted data in encrypted space. And the data remain encrypted until you make a decision to decrypt. So imagine you have online a series, gazillions, hundreds, thousands of software agents that you scour the web, and they scour and they search for individuals who, for example, have bought large quantities of fertilizer and large quantities of ball bearings and, you know, the kinds of things that you would use to build bombs. You send out these software agents, they go searching for people, and they find, let's say, a handful of people, I don't know, whatever. All this information is in encrypted space. So then they do a probabilistic analysis on the data that they find, and they find that three of them, they spit out, they think there's the 90% odd that these people might be actual potential terrorists. What happens with that data? The data goes, that data could constitute probable cause in terms of law enforcement. So you've got probable cause now, you send that to a judge. A judge looks at it. If he or she decides it's worthy of probable cause, they issue a warrant that enables the data to be decrypted and the personal identifiers associated with those individuals to go to the police to go and do what they need to do. So there are models that we can engage in using AI and amazing technology to do the kind of law enforcement, things that we legitimately need to do, but all in the context of a legal entity and like a probable cause. We have to have that. That is a very sound legal basis for the searches that we do. And combining that with encryption would allow us, for example, to do that.
The amount of data we have to deal with today demands that we use tools such as AI-driven AI-developed tools. Yeah. See, there are two main types of AI. Okay, there is AI where logic is developed by humans. Data is provided, either historical or real-time or through sensors or input. And then the thing makes decisions based on the logic or the logic altered by the data. The new type of cognitive or hard AI is not provided with logic, only data. Inputs, the most important one being location data, and all kinds of inputs in a car from thousands of sensors, et cetera, et cetera. So the amount of data and the speed in which the data comes is impossible for humans or humanly created algorithms to analyze. We need advanced AI systems to make sense and do what they do best, which is analyze deviations, anomalies. This is what should happen. This is what is happening. What does that mean? And take actions on that. So the potential for AI to help us deal with this new world is huge. And the better input we can provide, the better output we'll get.
We're gonna have to wrap things up here. Unfortunately, we won't have any time for any more audience questions, and really appreciate everybody. These are great questions. I wanted to just end with one last quick thing that I thought would be kind of fun, which is if everybody could just maybe give as a last soundbite here, what sort of a wacky prediction that they may have about, you know, where this industry is going to look like, what this industry is going to look like in the next 5 years. What surprises do you think may be coming, you know, in the next 5 years with regards to AI and cybersecurity? Okay, maybe. What do you think?
I'll go first. I would say that AI is not the future. It's actually the present. It's happening now. It's happening everywhere. I see companies doing AI all day long. I think the future will be, and that's maybe the topic for the next year's conference, would be the convergence between technologies. And I'm specifically talking about AI, blockchain, quantum computing, and eventually the holy grail is human enhancement. I think that's what excites me, looking in the future. And that's not going to be the far future. That's going to be the future of us and our kids. This is what my bold prediction, that maybe not next year, maybe 2 years from now or 3 years from now, that's going to be the topic of the conference.
So I have two concerns, and I'll tell you how out of these two concerns there are potential good to come out. One of the concerns is that we are coming into this game late. We're late. We don't have enough people. We don't have enough money. So we have to catch up. It's imperative that we catch up. Legislation, government, support, education, all of that needs legal frameworks, IP protection, everything needs urgent work to prepare us. And I'm hoping that we will rise to the challenge. And I'm hoping that Canada will use its brand. I mean, we are known for certain things. We are known for inventing, for innovating, for applying social responsible business practices, okay? Reinvent capitalism. As the book published by Schulich said, it is possible to reinvent capitalism, okay, and have good. So my hope is that we will be able to do that, and my hope is that as a result, we will be able to deal with some of the social issues that will come out of this, okay, because we will have them. People will be displaced. Some we may be able to retrain, some we may not. How are we going to pay for them? How are we going to deal with tax issues, immigration issues? So all of these challenges are an opportunity for us to jump into the ring and provide leadership.
I don't know if you've been following AI in terms of the unbelievable successes coming out of, you know, the AI machines that beat the Go people and beat the, you know, all these games and the chess masters. And it's remarkable. And what someone was pointing out to me is that the capacity of the AI to actually do the learning, not just they're set at, you know, a gazillion things and they grasp it, but that they can actually apply that and learn and evolve. That is the phenomenal aspect of AI that will, in my view, exceed a human intellect and capacity. So the challenge and the wonder is teaching AI the unique aspects of human nature in terms of things that are valued and how that can be reflected in the operations of the AI. When I look at the kind of deep learning that Jeff Hinton has developed, and you have to remember, Jeff Hinton at the Vector Institute at U of T, his stuff, like 20 years ago, was discounted. He was just cast aside as being, you know, a nutcake. I mean, can you imagine? And I'm so proud of him now. I mean, he's like God in the AI world. What that says to me is never discount the possibility of anything. So I am the eternal optimist, because believe me, if you knew the number of times people tell me there's not going to be any privacy anymore, I would be a millionaire if I counted all those times. So what you have to do is think of how to get to the people who are the brilliant people doing all the coding and the work in AI and the deep learning, and get to them and say, how can we infuse the values of things like privacy and freedom into AI operations? How can that be reflected so that these entities can then learn that and incorporate that in terms of what's happening? I firmly believe we can do that, and I believe that we must do that. Thank you.
Great. And I'll just pick my last prediction. My prediction would be similar to Anne. I think that contrary to a lot of these discussions are around like the fear of the sort of displacement that will occur and all the sort of negative impacts, absolutely. But I also think, you know, as an optimist, that this is going to be a great age to be a human. I think we're also going to be redefining what it is to be human, what intelligence is, and I think that it's a really a great opportunity for all of us to up our game in the face of what will be an exciting time of new intelligences. So with that, I appreciate the speakers for coming out today and for everybody else. And so thanks a lot.